So are there questions of understanding regarding the speech of Carsten, please?
Have you also developed tools for archiving or only the model? Because it looks like you need 5 hours for archiving one item, and that is not possible. If it's too complex, nobody will use it.
Yeah, maybe it's complex, but the information is already in the internet, so you can just depend on what fan sites are doing.
You don't know what site will disappear tomorrow.
Yeah, but
games are released every year is constantly increasing. So
I think you can assume let's say for the Western world 1,200 games per year. I think this is a number, and it's an interesting question. I think this will drive us to maybe some models how this metadata could be achieved. So please
let me say something on the numbers of video games out there. So we had the discussions a few weeks ago, and we came up with an amount of 50,000, 40,000, maybe total video games in history, so the complete set, 50,000, 40,000.
Yeah.
So that's, for a library, that's no number.
I still think that's low. We were having a discussion about that last night, and we think it could be as many as 5 times that many. But it's debatable, because no one's really done a good survey. You can look through TOSEC, if any of you guys know TOSEC, which is a very unofficial, but they're trying to catalog every game and every platform as a fan community thing right now. If you go to the TOSEC databases, I mean, they already have tens of thousands, and they're not really that close to being canonical. But I mean, that's sort of, it's still a lot. 50,000 to 200,000, maybe there's no difference. So I just wanted to point out.
Henry, you want to answer also?
I just wanted to say, if you wanted to see what a library record for a computer game looked like, and we have internet access, I could just show you the Stanford catalog, some of the games that we have. You could compare it. In fact, it doesn't take us that long to catalog a game, and it's not that, the records are a little bit shorter maybe than this, because we don't include the information about the emulator, we just include the digital object itself, but you'd be surprised how long the records are. And that's, as I mentioned in my talk, it's an institutional model of a library. Libraries are organized to produce that kind of information. They're organized to use book in hand, you know, object in hand cataloging. They probably wouldn't go out to the internet to look up things generally, but we do have records that you can compare this model to. I think our records are basically just, as Carsten said, they're based on a slight twist off of the way books are cataloged. And they're not really that specific to computer games. There's a lot that's missing there, but these are actual records that really exist and really are being used to find games. If we want to look, see that, we can easily take a look.
Okay. So I want to ask a follow-up question. So what do you think about the possibility to set a system up? Maybe you can compare with Wikipedia. So you provide a metadata schema which you agreed on internationally, and then ask the community to fill in the metadata. Sounds that for you like a feasible approach?
I think for me, the part I would want to stick to probably is the old model of cataloging from the object in hand for the information that's available for the object in hand. For example, the publisher, the date, the developer, should be, if you've got the box for the game, you shouldn't need to rely on the fan community to provide that information. I think that's something that should be done with the item in hand. I think there's a lot of information, though, that you can rely, you can try to have the community provide. I think Wikipedia would be a good model for collaborative work. I'm not sure that we don't have to think a little bit more in some cases about the community, and in particular, there's an academic model that I like of people actually authoring and signing contributions. So not that there would be necessarily an academic standard for that, but I think it's very helpful to know who has actually submitted things very often. I do, though, think that we need to differentiate between description of the object itself and description of other information that could be brought in through the community, through something like a Wikipedia approach.
I think that's an interesting point, because often on the early games, like, for example, that Pitfall one you had, it had David Crane as the author, and I don't know if it says that David Crane was the author on the early Atari games, whether it specifically has the author. So I agree, it would be good to differentiate between information that you got by looking at the item and information that you got from somewhere else. I think if you look at metadata efforts on the internet, the Moby Games site, if anyone knows mobygames.com, is entirely a fan site, but it's extremely comprehensive right now. It has scans, and it's particularly good for authors. If you want to see what a particular author related to a video game does, and you go to mobygames.com, then you'll find like a large amount of information about them. So I think that's an interesting model, because that's all user contributed, and you can see which user has contributed what. Yeah, see if you can bring it up. But it is interesting, because that's, you know, I would say if you're looking formally for like if you're looking formally in terms of, you know, you want to make sure you only have trusted people doing it. So type in, say, well, a famous creator in the keyword search, like Miyamoto, or indeed David Crane. Yeah.
That's nothing like that.
I'd be interested to see what it comes up with. I would type in David Crane as well, not just. Oh, okay. We'll see what happens.
Thank you.
Press a turn.
Let's not do it.
Oh no, they're going to find out. There you go. So there's David Crane. So you see, this isn't too bad. And scroll down, and you see his credits. Somewhere down here. There you go. So that is pretty good. If you're talking about metadata, and this is entirely fan-based, so I'm kind of keen that whatever we do, we don't reinvent the wheel. I think we may be in danger. I think the important bit is getting stuff like the physical image of the disk, and maybe some basic information. Like, these guys don't really do box scans or disk scans because they don't have the storage space. So I think box scans and disk scans, for example, is something that it would really be complementary to the community to do. But I don't. You don't want to get to the stage where you spend 5 years just doing this again.
Other questions, please. Yes.
Well, I would like to know how your archives are going to be used in education. I mean, in most professional areas, think of architects. They don't necessarily think that newest buildings are the best ones. They study buildings made over the last few hundred years. In computer science, the newest new is what matters, and there's very little sense of that you can learn something from history. I would say, if you want to get strong backing up for your archives, you have to have a motivation from educational needs and the use of studies in interactivity and such thing. I'd like to know your experiences in this area.
Well, I teach a course on the history of computer game design at Stanford. I have for 4 years now, fifth year soon. And there are other courses at Stanford on subjects like designing of characters in computer games and so on. And all of the, obviously in my history of computer game design, which is primarily attended by computer science students, I get about 100 students a year, probably 70 of those students are computer science students. That's an academic use, and what I have the students do is do a case study of a computer game design or designer or company. That's their big project. Currently, every year it's a little bit better, but currently it's very difficult to choose a game that you find interesting as a historical case study
and find adequate source material, even for a term paper. I'm not talking about a dissertation now. I'm talking about a 15 to 20 page term paper. It's very difficult to find adequate documentation for many games in terms of what were the designers trying to do, finding a copy of the game that's running, and so on. The papers that we're doing in the class, incidentally, the case studies with the permission of the students, we're archiving and, you know, making openly available. Right now there are about 200 papers that you can get to of these students, so we're starting to build some literature about the history of these games based on what the students are doing to try to fill in some of those blanks. But I think both from the point of view of describing what has happened to this point in computer game design, and if your interest is more prescribing how to design a character or how to do something like that, the historical approach is very interesting. I have one student, for example, who's very interested in non-photorealistic animation. And so he would like to look at things like cell shading and so on in computer games. And it's very interesting, if you're interested in looking in that topic, to go back to historical examples of cell shading or other kinds of ideas that people had and see what happened. Study those as cases of did it work? What were the problems people faced? Why was it successful? Why was it not successful? You know, as a historian, I don't need to do that myself. I consider history a value in itself, but for people with more practical interests, history can be one method of trying to understand what the possibilities are for something that you might be doing now.
The other thing I was going to say is what I'd like to see from an educational point of view is, say, I guess Stanford has a really good collection of software, and it would be great if a student wanted to look at a piece of software and it was archived properly, that they could simply go to a computer where it was archived and load it on an emulator. Because right now your choices are go find it in a large amount of boxes, try and get it running with the original hardware, right? So.
Well, what we've done is we have a historical collection. It's about 25,000 pieces. That's largely in boxes. But for this very reason, I also created a collection. I should say our historical collection pretty much goes up to about 1993, up to about, you know, Castle Wolfenstein and Doom in that period. In addition to that collection, I've been building a separate collection that we have in our media center. They've allowed us there to set up consoles and computers and so on to run. You know, it's only eight or so machines, but it covers, we picked ones like NES and so on, Atari 2600, that covers a wide range of games, at least for these projects. Mm-hmm. So that we are, for materials we're acquiring now, for computer games we're acquiring now, we're putting those in a collection where students can check them out. They can, much like in a media center collection, they can view them there if they choose, or they can take them home and view them like they check out DVDs.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the way to do it. And I really think it would be great if we could extend that to, you know, lots of collections over a large time period in conjunction with the archive. So yeah. that was my view.
Are you satisfied with the answers? All right. Then there is another question in the back there.
Thanks. This is. Been very, very interesting, and as a copyright lawyer, I want to note that lots of the most interesting and most useful to free software copyright cases in the United States recently have been involving computer games. A lot of the recent cases that established that reverse engineering for interoperability is a fair use rather than a copyright infringement comes out of emulator and cartridge emulation programs. The exemptions that Simon discussed from that the Internet Archive asked for are another important piece of building up the picture that copyright can be restrictive as well as helpful. And so I don't so much have a question, but a thank you for the work that you're doing in archiving this material, demonstrating its cultural significance, and helping us all to see how copyright law has to change to accommodate sort of our continued access to that culture.
So, thank you. So am I right if I understand you in this way, that the case of computer games help you to liberate the copyright treatment at all for other digital artifacts also and text and this stuff? Yeah, I think this is a very interesting comment.
Can I just throw something in there just to tie on? We're also doing archival work that's more traditional archival work relating to games, trying to gather documentation, that sort of thing. And one thing we've just started doing is trying to track down some of the documents of some of the court cases, you know, like some of the Nintendo cases, the Ralph Baer case, you know, things like that. So we've been contacting the district courts and trying to get, you know, the materials out of there. Are there any tricks to that? Because it's a very kind of slow and cumbersome process. I mean, is there any advice? I'm asking you because you're a lawyer. Is there any way of, we would basically like to build up an archive of as much public documentation as we can about these legal issues around computer games. Is there an easy way to do that? Okay. Yeah.
Okay, then, please.
Okay, maybe just some follow-up comment on this. Well, I'm working for a computer research lab for a really big computer company, and I think that the overall argument there might be a little bit different. So it's your case of gaming points to a very interesting problem, but there might be more than one solution to it, and one might want to be aware of most of them. As far as I understand, the problem that you highlighted was the duration of the copyright might by far extend the durability of the physical medium, but society has a right to know what happened in the past. So one way to look at this is that copyright shouldn't come for free for the owner. So if he wants to have copyright for this duration, he's in charge of actually guaranteeing bit-precise copies for the duration he wants to enforce this copyright. Otherwise, he wouldn't fulfill his obligation to society and to historic research. And maybe this is some kind of angle that could be used in the copyright discussion to say, listen, you want to benefit, but this is a deal where both sides have to win. And this has to come with obligations. So it's not necessarily just exempting all kinds of digital rights protection measures. This will be really, really difficult to get through, but the notion of obligations being attached to copyright might be a way forward.
So we just can say yes, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, next one. And then you and you.
Another yes. Question, a statement. Just a statement. In my opinion, we need many, many more archives like yours, because you can't rely on just one or some institutions. In the history for books, there was a possibility for everybody to have its own library for archiving books, and the big libraries, they burned down, or there were wars or something like that, and some items only survived because private people collected them. And we need simple possibilities, tools for everybody or for small institutions to archive digital objects. Mm-hmm. And we can't rely only on just, for example, Internet Archive. It's you're doing a very good job, but we need more.
I think you're talking about certainly with regard to the private archiving of stuff, because we intend to privately archive games. It's definitely not going to be just in one place that could accidentally get burnt down, because that would be a bad idea. So basically, the Internet Archive has its main data center in San Francisco right now, and we have multiple copies of all the files we're archiving. And then we're just in the process of setting up a data center in Amsterdam. So, I mean, I'm just making a point. There are going to be many copies. We're not going to.
So
we'd love for other people to do it.
Yeah.
So,
I agree with you too. But you must have in mind. So games or digital artifacts in common are very appropriate to this because there is no difference between the original and the copy. It's almost the same. And for sure, with the internet, we have a new type of archive which allows us to store copies everywhere we want to store it. But this one consequence of what you say is that the meaning of metadata schemas, which all agreed upon, raises, because if you have these different archives, it's important that you can search them idly with only one search. And so these are the consequences of what you are want to set up. So
can
we
I just
have
one quick
yes,
thing
please.
On that. In addition to the institutional point that Andreas made, there is a page. I'll just tell you about it. You might want to take a look at it. It's a project centered in Stanford, but involving a whole bunch of other institutions called LOCKS, which stands for Lots of Copies, Keep Stuff Safe.
Yeah.
So it's software that allows collections so that are. The work of the collecting is done in a distributed fashion, but the collection that results is held at all the participating institutions, and there's a system of polling and checking for problems, you know, if one partner goes, the server goes down, or if they lose, if some of their files are corrupted, the polling mechanism finds that and repairs the damaged copies. So far, the game, that was done primarily for initially for the preservation of science and engineering electronic periodical publications, okay? They just started their first humanities-oriented program, which is dealing with hypertext literature and so on, but beginning with a format they understand, which is a more periodical kind of thing. So it's literature about those formats. And we were able to get a couple of game publications in there, like the you may know this publication called Game Studies that's on the web. That is included in that collection. So that will be, there'll be 20, I think, institutions that will be participating in that, and that will be, then in a sense, a distributed project. The problem with games is that they're so complicated compared to these formats that are relatively well understood in libraries, like texts and periodicals and things like that. So we're sort of the people that get told, well, let us figure out these other problems first and then we'll get to you eventually. But we will, you know, they have our ear, we have their ear, and we hope that we'll be able to do something with them.
So we are in a lucky position that we have no follow-up session, so I think I can allow some more questions. I have counted here one, two, and some questions there, three.
Okay.
So. Please.
Actually, not. I don't have much of a question. I actually have a dozen of comments to make, which have not been covered yet. I've been following the gaming or the computer games community or the computer games since I played them in the early 80s, and many things now. I visited the Game On exhibition in London, which later moved to Edinburgh, which was a wonderful time machine because it had the PDP-11 and the old consoles set up, and you could actually play them, and you could play the arcade, the original arcade games, without having to put in the coins, insert the coins. And it was a wonderful exhibition, and it reminded me of many things, and this discussion combined reminded me of many things, many issues which have to be addressed in the future in order to preserve the experience of computer games. What I see is that the librarians and the archivars have trouble coming to terms with the medium, since a computer as a multi-purpose machine is not like a piece of paper that you can perhaps fold and write on, but that's all you can do. And if you know origami, drink out of, if you're creative. But you have to stretch the concept far. And the computer is a multi-purpose machine, making grasping it very hard. For instance, even if you preserve the ROMs and emulate the game, you won't be able to preserve the feeling, for instance, of waiting for the cassette to load the game and listen to the loading music, which was created only for the purpose of bridging the time between the loading and the gaming, the actual playing time. And some of the loading music are very interesting, very good pieces of art, which are unique, which even got remixed, where there is a whole movement that remixes those game, that game music.
I think if you use a real-time emulator like Commodore 64, then it will load stuff in real time and play the loading music during that, actually. So that specific
then again,
example. That
do we want to wait for 15 minutes for the game to play the game?
I'm just saying that that specific example, I think, is actually dealt with BitPerfect.
Okay.
But yeah.
Mm. Next point. The next point are the Infocom goodies. You remember the Infocom adventures? The postcards, the stuff that was in there that was added, like little plastics. You cannot reproduce that anymore. And sometimes, as in, for instance, the case of, there is a game called RMS Titanic, you even had to resort to those add-ons to that physical to those physical objects. You had to extract out of out of a folder some secret code or some microfilm that you had to bring to a library and enlarge in some creative way in order to read a code or to read a hint to solve the game. See, these are parts of the experience that cannot be in any electronic or feasible way be reproduced.
I disagree. I think they can be, because the actual artifacts can be scanned in. Even the three-dimensional ones, you could do 2D scans of them. And I believe there are some people online who emulate the code wheels. You can get code wheel emulation for specific titles.
Well, the code wheels, yes. But for instance, in this specific game, you had an ink cartridge that you had to use in a pen, and you had to empty by writing it. And only when the ink cartridge was empty, you had to open it up. And inside the plastic case of the cartridge, there was a microfilm inserted.
I think that's an exception rather than a rule. I mean, I'm not going to argue with you that can be accurate.
No, I think you're totally right, and this shows how big the challenge really is.
I'm almost through.
I definitely agree.
We're halfway through. This is halftime. Yeah. What saddens me, for instance, regarding the game on this exhibition, is that I also had the opportunity to have a look at the backstage of this exhibition, and there was a Robotron arcade machine that broke down that couldn't be repaired anymore, and which actually, because of the hardware failure, was deprived from future or deprived society from resorting to that or playing that game in the future. And this is something that I'm very worried about, because an arcade game, if you want to recreate the experience of playing Robotron 2084, you'd have to sit there, push the buttons and move the joystick, and that cannot be really emulated.
Yeah, this is pretty much the discussions which were done in the art world. So regarding early electronic art pieces, so we have the same questions here with games. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, the issue is authenticity. I mean, I pose the question: how close do you need to get to the original experience for certain types of appreciation? And I think, you know, for most research people would do, for most kinds of vicarious experiences people would like to have, a close approximation would be good enough. You know, for example, there are there's arcade hardware that you can add on to your PC now. You know, you can have the joysticks and all of that in kind of an arcade format with multiple buttons and so on. You can buy that. And I imagine, you know, I would encourage people to emulate that sort of thing as much as possible. But I've been, you know, for example, there was recently a compilation of Atari games that was brought out with the joystick. And I found that it was a good collection of games and so on, but the joystick was such a was so bad in comparison to the original experience that I couldn't play the games. I was totally uninterested in playing the games. So I think, you know, there's a, and that was not for any research purpose. That was just a case of, you know, just wanting to enjoy them. So I think this will have to be tuned to the kinds of experiences we're trying to enable. In many cases, an emulation that does not provide an exact sort of physical replica of the original experience will be enough for somebody, but for other needs, it won't be.
Okay, two more questions, two more comments and a question, so I'll end up with a question. one comment that occurred to me is that following how some of the game companies, I think Sierra has been a very strong one in this, trying to lock down the ability to download some of their vintage games that they don't market anymore, reminded me of how willing the computer companies, the game companies, software companies are to protect themselves into oblivion. They're erasing themselves from cultural memory or societal memory. I'd like to see the behavior towards non-marketed games, stuff that is out of the market. I want to see that changed. I want to have a law that prohibits companies from retracting what they regard as their intellectual property, which, however, has become a societal memory and a societal experience. Or civil experience, I don't know the exact English expression for this. Because once you sell a book like War and Peace, it becomes part of society. You sell it because you think that society will accept it. And then like a book, you can go to a library and you can read, but a computer game or some piece of software you need the hardware to run on, and you have these copy protection measures. There is no real copy protection in books. There is only copyright enforcement, perhaps. But the enforcement regarding software is before the fact. It even prevents you from... It prevents future generations to access... to even reproduce the feeling and the experiences that a previous generation had. If I want to relive what some author wrote in the 12th century, I can go to a library and I can read it and I have instant access to it. But in even if I want to photocopy the book, I can do so and I can read it, I can reproduce it. But in the regarding copy protection and software, this is a deprivation from something that has been willingly produced to be put into society. I'm redundant, sorry. Yeah,
just let me suggest real quickly there a couple of test cases to kind of watch. This is just starting. people in massively multiplayer games who have created characters and sometimes lived as these characters in virtual worlds, you know, 5 years. When those games are pulled down or, you know, various other things can happen. There can be a server crash at an inopportune time that deprives your character of some ability that you had and so on. The issue begins to come up: who actually owns that character? You know, who actually, and of course, embodied in that character are all of these experiences that you have personally had. You feel like you've created that character, and so on. So there have been, in Korea, there have been a couple of cases now, and some other. I'm sure there will be many others pursuing this idea of who actually owns what's created in these virtual spaces. I think. It'll be very interesting to see what happens with those, because I think they might have a little bit of a bearing on this idea of who actually owns this, what happens in these virtual worlds that are created through games.
Okay, my question now, which is the last point, and the question is, how far is... This is a real question. It's I didn't make it up just to have one. What do you do with games which never made it. For instance, there is a PC version of Novagan's Damocles, which is far better from the screenshots that have leaked through the internet, far better than the Amiga version. But you cannot get that game because Psygnosis produced it and had a copyright or some other quibble with the original producer, which was Novagan from Birmingham, which are now out of business, or actually out of the commercial, the public business. They serve the military now. But you cannot get to that game anymore. So something has been created which is very valuable, but it's locked away somewhere. Mm. You cannot get to it.
Certainly within the US, I don't believe that there's any reason why I think that you should be able to privately archive that if you can find a disk of it, and I don't think that anybody would object. So all you need to do, are you saying it's a problem because they won't give you the disk, or it's a problem because you're not allowed to do it?
It's a problem, I mean, it's a problem for archiving because you cannot even get to that source. For the archivers, this is from the perspective of someone who wants to preserve it for future generations who may be smarter in handling all this copyright mess.
Let me suggest this is not a new problem at all. Archives have many unpublished materials in their archives. In fact, in American copyright law, the copyright provisions were a little different for unpublished manuscripts than they were for books for a long time. What I would suggest is the question is more about the tactics of how do you get to those things than it is about, you know, a new kind of archival practice. And I think that's very difficult. I think that to be able to get to those kinds of materials in a way that would probably satisfy most institutions, that archival institutions, you would have to approach the company and try to get them from them, which I'm very much in favor of.
Are there efforts to do so?
Well, I think the IGDA is beginning to tend more to history. There have been, which is the International Game Developers Association, has had roundtables and things like that and sessions the last 2 years at the Game Developers Conference. I think Simon's now kind of chairing, I guess I would say, the efforts there. I hope that as a kind of companion to the collaboration side of this whole area, that once we see that there's a critical mass of work being done, and we can show that to something like the Game Developers Association, that we can get to a point where we have some sort of an authorized kind of project. Much as, you know, with the film industry, it took a very, very long time before any kind of concerted effort was made that was authorized, in a sense, by the industry, and with movies going into collections that the industry was happy with. By that time, 90% of the early movies were already gone. We have a chance, we're still early enough in the game, that if we could get something going along those lines, we could begin to rescue some of that material.
What is your point? What is your opinion on maybe publishing games in the future when their copyright is not being infringed anymore, or when you can actually have permission to do so, in order to bug fix them or enhance them? Because I remember many games which had bugs which were never fixed because their marketing life was over, their shelf life was expired. But there could be a new community movement who actually takes care of that old source code and makes the even maybe extending the games, not only bug fixing them, so to make them finally playable. Which may be another reason for archiving software. And I'm done with this question. You're hereby dismissed.
I would cite that, you know, the Tolkien papers, for example, those are unpublished, unfinished manuscripts that were then completed and published later by editors, people in the family, of course, with the permission of the rights holders. That sort of thing can happen. Of course, that's an archival problem, but once we've have the archives where those materials are saved, we can of course make them available to people for any kind of use they want.
And there are some people who are publishing source code now, like the source code for Doom has been released by id, and people have massively improved the Z Doom and a bunch of versions of Doom. So it is happening. It's just with often it's the software that gets released and not the source code. But I'd rather have one than none. So.
Okay, next one here, and then the last one maybe was there. No, yeah.
I just wondered if you could say anything about curatorial attitudes towards the Is this better? Can you say something about the curatorial attitudes towards preserving the physical artifacts, like the original discs and boxes and things like that? Because, I mean, we talk a lot about how the magnetic media is not going to be readable, but one of the lessons from archaeology is that you're always still interested in the original artifact, not just for process research and things like that, but because often there's new technology that maybe it's not readable in the Amiga drive, but maybe your magnetic imager from 2020 can read it just fine. So, I mean, are there active projects looking at that, or do people just not really?
There are projects collecting the hardware, certainly. The standard practices, I'm a collector curator. The preservationists are the people who deal with the actual sort of long-term maintenance of the artifacts. And with games and computers, it's kind of interesting. I mean, some things that are standard practice, for example, include removing all the batteries from the consoles or the computers. That's a valid thing to do to prevent damage over the long term to the machines, but it also makes it very difficult to actually use them. And I've run across that problem. I think right now we're in a stage where it's mostly, actually Andreas is one of the people who, and we also have a hardware collection where we're collecting, but I don't think we know very much about the long-term preservation of the artifacts. And I would say that the communities out beyond the formal institutions know an unbelievable amount more than we do in the library. You know, the collection that we have at Stanford is in a rare books and manuscripts collection, because that's the only special collections department we have in a library. So you can imagine how much a rare books and manuscripts person knows about setting up a console machine or putting a battery back into a computer, stuff like that. So it's just like, it's basically stabilizing the artifacts as best as they can with the knowledge that they have. And, next Monday I'll be at a meeting of a thing called the Electronic Media Group in Portland, which is mainly going to be people who work in museums and try to preserve interactive art and that kind of thing. They do the best they can to sort of stabilize the artifacts, but I don't think anybody really has the solution for permanent long-term conservation of these artifacts, which is why emulation and these other strategies are so important.
Yeah.
So, last question, please. Okay.
Well, again, maybe less of a question than some encouraging remarks. So, from what I see, you are actually highlighting a problem that will become more and more important in future. And I think Andreas actually pointed this out by saying, if we can actually preserve this stuff, we can preserve everything. You have the same problem in accountability and security, where people for a long time thought that it's good enough to sign just the documents before realizing that they would have to sign the execution context too, because without the execution context, the document could simply be interpreted anyway. So map this to scenarios where you actually have to provide proof for 20, 30, 40 years in the medical environment or in legal environment. There are a number of institutions out there who by law have to preserve their data this long. So although you should remain interested in games and do your thing there, in case you need some additional support, you may only just look beyond your own gaming horizon, because as I said, these problems will be there more often than you think, and maybe you already have some solutions for someone who actually would have some money even in order to fund your efforts as well. So this just as some kind of advice. And I think we will come to this with respect to emulators, which is also an interesting topic, because given the ever-increasing cycle of innovation in technology, the question is, might emulation be a natural cycle of technological evolutions, meaning that maybe you should introduce the next generation before you can emulate the last one. in order to just have some sustainability of your information and transcoding and so on. So this just as an idea.
So this gives me the opportunity to make a hint to the panel tomorrow, which is somehow related to this one. And this is exactly the stuff we discussed there. These are all the technical questions. We have one emulator programmer here with Jürgen Buchmüller and another specialist, István Fabian, and they will point at these technical problems which appear when if you try to do all the stuff with emulators and so. And so here are the last 1,000 comments.
One of the questions that I forgot to ask was about firmware and what to do with kickstart disks or the firmware that you need to play or boot an Amiga, which is not essentially a computer game, but it's a piece of code that you need to run the game at all. But I think I should ask that tomorrow at the and save it up for the emulation panel.
That's it. And before you go, I was asked by the organizers to say one last thing. There are taking place workshops on Sunday at the Technische University, and they say a lot of people subscribe there but forget to buy the tickets for lunch. You can buy the tickets there at the info counter. If you have subscribed there, please do it. Otherwise, you must stay hungry. So I thank you all very much.